Good morning, and you're tuned into KBOO. You're listening to More Talk Radio. It's Wednesday morning. I'm Eric Jorgensen. Joining us in by phone this morning for the program is author Sherry Wolf. She's an independent journalist who writes on a wide variety of political topics and for numerous publications, including The Nation. She's an activist, a leader in the International Socialist Organization, and an organizer for the National Equality March. Her new, highly acclaimed book is Sexuality and Socialism, History, Politics, and Theory of LGBT Liberation. She's going to be speaking tomorrow night at Portland State University in the Smith Memorial Student Union Building, Room 294. That's tomorrow, Thursday, April 8th at 8 p.m. Sherry Wolf, it is a pleasure to have you on the program.
Good morning, Eric.
So I want to get to talking about your book and the details of that, but the first thing I want to ask you, it's become hard, especially in the past year, to sort of even mention socialism without it sort of being somewhat of a taboo or a four-letter word, mostly because of its appropriation by the right, and it's their very successful campaign to sort of twist the meaning of this word and making many people who would actually benefit from more sort of socialist thinking in the way we look at government in the programs that we implement, those things would actually benefit most some of the people who most strongly oppose it. What's going on here? This seems like in the past year it's hit somewhat of a high water mark.
Well, what's fascinating to me about the sort of attempted smears by Glenn Beck and Sarah Palin and their ilk, the Tea Party flotsam or whatever, is that it hasn't really stuck. The Gallup poll that came out back in February of this year that polled nationally people's opinions about socialism, 53% of people who vote for the Democrats ordinarily have a favorable opinion of socialism, and actually a third of people under the age of 35, or I should say under the age of 30, have a favorable opinion of socialism. So despite all the smears, despite all the naysaying, despite all the hoo-ha about what really is not socialism, people still have a favorable notion of a concept that they rightly associate with help for the poor and working people, and something having to do with billionaires not getting their way.
That's actually encouraging, because it's been so strange for me to watch the events of the past year unfold, and no one's talking about all of the socialized programs that we have in this country that are some of the best, most effective programs we have. The police department, the fire department, in a way, the library, Medicare. It seems like there's people don't want to equate the idea of socialism as a political philosophy with these actual implementations of it.
Well, let's segregate out the people who are regular people and the sort of kind of talking head, whatever, folks who dominate, the land of Fox News, because we, of course, know that we live in different worlds from them. They want to use it as a smear. And frankly, it didn't work too well when they tried to smear Obama with that. Not that I think he is a socialist. We never see Comrade Obama at the meetings, by the way. but the fact is they tried to use it as a slander, because I guess liberal isn't good enough anymore, and it didn't stick. And so I think that it's important that progressives and people on the left stop using the talking points of the right wing, which seems to sort of live in 1953. They can't get out of a McCarthyite Cold War, kind of bubble. And I don't think it helps our side or even reflects reality for us to continue to talk as if the consciousness in this country is the way it was 50 years ago.
Yeah, it's strange, because you don't see anyone sort of on the left or the liberal or the even just center or something, someone who's not far right, using things like, oh, the oligarchs or the nepotism as these kind of slurs, in the same way that socialism as a word sort of seems to get abused.
Yeah, but of course we know why that is, because despite all of the kind of false notions that the left somehow runs the media. In fact, the media is owned and controlled by and large by major corporations. And that's why I can't not mention this. I just spent, my 17 minutes this morning watching that WikiLeaks video of what happened in Iraq 3 years ago, in which Reuters journalists were executed by American soldiers by air, along with another 10 or dozen or so people, including a couple of children who were severely injured. And, that's the kind of thing. It took sleuthing on the part of people who essentially had to decode however it is they got this clip to show what, war for oil and empire really looks like. And that video, in my opinion, in its entirety, ought to be running on every network television show, news station, CNN, MSNBC, in its entirety. We need to see what this war actually looks like from the perspective, actually, of the people who are on the receiving end of these bombs and bullets.
If, just for our listeners, if you're not familiar, this video, which I think leaked maybe 2 days ago, and I believe the website that you can watch the video at is, I want to say it's collateralmurder.org, or you can go to WikiLeaks. It's a 17-minute video that basically depicts the footage taken from a helicopter in Iraq during what really amounts to a massacre. Like Sherry said, there was two Reuters journalists that were killed. An ambulance came to try to help a man who was wounded. The helicopter took out the ambulance as well. There was two children inside. You can hear all of the soldiers sort of talking in a very sacred way about the human lives that they're taking, and it's extremely it's disturbing, and it's what's even more disturbing is that this is the first footage of this kind that we've seen. And we see so much of the same sort of stock footage on the news of soldiers walking proudly with all their gear, helping civilians, talking to Iraqi children, and we don't really see any of the sort of the actual footage that would stir sort of a more imminent feeling in this country to try to stop what's going on in the Middle East. Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I think it's one of many stories. I mean, I think about something like, another huge news story today, the mine disaster in West Virginia, which on the front pages or, inside of the national sections of the major newspapers across this country is being called an accident. But you actually look at the facts of the situation, that the mine owners, which, by the way, made $3 billion last year, it was non-union. They ignored systematically, being written up, that they weren't ventilating their mines properly. This was cold-blooded murder. This was not an accident. These 25 miners died yesterday needlessly because mine owners refused to pay whatever it is, the few thousands or even tens or hundreds of thousands or whatever it would cost to ensure the safety of their workers. And they were killed. They weren't accidentally dying as a result of an accident. They were murdered by their bosses, who will probably never go to trial for what is really callous execution of their workers, about whom they don't care, because it costs less for them to pay the insurance money to their families who are grieving than it would for them to actually ventilate these mines properly.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Sherry Wolf. She is an activist and a leader in the International Socialist Organization. Her newest book is Sexuality and Socialism, History, Politics, and Theory of LGBT Liberation. If you have a question for Sherry or a comment, please feel free to call in. The number is 503-231-8187. More about the mine issue. When that happened, it struck me as so... it was surprising to me that still in the 21st century, when we have the technology and the capability to almost unequivocally prevent these sorts of needless accidents, that they still occur strictly in the name of, like you said, profits for these very, very few people. And unfortunately, situations and scenarios similar to what happened in the mine, I fear, happen every day, not just in dramatic ways as far as industrial accidents, but even in just people not getting the fair pay, the fair benefits that they're due, is also sort of a form of this putting undue risk on your workers in the name of profits. I was kind of hoping in the past year that that we'd see more drastic changes with the Obama presidency, which haven't really come into place. I was wondering if we could talk a little bit about
sure.
what's happening on the national level with we've seen a lot of promises that were made by President Obama in the campaign that have not been filled, and in fact, in many regards, things are getting worse as far as they're getting politics and policy is getting further embedded within sort of the large corporate America. We saw this just yesterday with the net neutrality ruling and Comcast. What is your take on all of this? Why is this sort of change that we all wanted to see happening so much slower than we would have wanted or expected?
Well, in my opinion, I think it's because all of the pressure on the Obama the overwhelming majority of the pressure on the Obama administration is coming from the right and is coming from corporate America. I mean, let's be blunt. Amongst ourselves, we have to be honest. Whoever is going to run the world's largest empire is going to have to run it in the interest of the people who own the place, not the rest of us. And unless there is mass pressure from below among ordinary working class people, as there was in the 1930s, and again in the 1960s to bring about the New Deal and the Great Society programs, we will not see that kind of progress. So what we see are these sort of minor tweaks coming through an eyedropper instead of the kinds of massive changes that people actually, who did vote for the Obama administration, were expecting. And I think we're going to, it points to the necessity of building mass movements and struggles and protests and, you know, educational forums and all sorts of things like that in order to actually put pressure on an administration to get the goods. It's why I affiliated myself with the National Equality March back in October. It's why I continue to put my name to Equality Across America. It's why I'm coming out to Portland and Eugene this week to speak on the case for socialism as well as on sexuality and sports in Eugene, because I think we need to build protest movements if we're going to get any kind of, you know, real relief. You know, you take a look at the health care plan. Right.
Yeah.
You know, people on one level, I really understand why it is that so many people feel hopeful in the last week and a half as a result of that passage. Number one, a party that basically runs Congress and is in the White House finally stood up and said we're the majority and put something through and showed legislation, even unpopular and, in my opinion, kind of crappy, where just legislation can be passed by a majority party without even a single vote from the Republicans. People are also happy to see that the bigots and the teabagging sort of, you know, nincompoops who were spitting at John Lewis and screaming faggot at Barney Frank and all the rest of that crap got their comeuppance. I am sympathetic with that. But I think we have to look at the fact that the content of these policies being pushed through is not what it is that people wanted. People want genuine universal health care. People want genuine relief on the foreclosure disaster. And the, you know, people need jobs. And that is not what is being delivered. And I think if we're going to see that, we're going to need to build the kinds of protest movements and pressure inside of our workplaces and communities to fight for it.
One thing that I get discouraged by is sometimes it just seems that it's sort of that kind of uprising from the grassroots level, from the people, the lay workers, almost impossible now. I mean, we even the politicians we choose to vote for, the only way we sort of learn about these people is through their marketing campaigns, which of course take funding, and that funding comes from major corporations. And just because politics is so fueled by money, and especially big money at every level, it's hard to see sometimes how a protest or how this sort of political pressure that's only political pressure and not financial pressure will be able to bring about the real change that ultimately I feel that we are going to need as a country.
Well, we have to remember, look, their profits, alas, are not made by them. They're made by us, right? It's not the people who are the Bill Gateses who are making the computers and developing the software, whose intelligence and whose brawn is actually producing the wealth that he enjoys. It's ordinary working class people. And when people don't have a sense that they have that power, that we actually can withhold our labor, that we can strike, that we can protest, that we can shut down production, that we can shut down transportation, communications, that we can actually grind their system to a halt, which is the kind of sort of whiff we got back earlier last month on March 4th when tens of thousands of students, teachers, and staff at the schools throughout the University of California system shut things down in order to protest 32% tuition hikes and privatization throughout the system. You get a whiff of what the power of solidarity and organized forces among people who produce the wealth and the people who actually should be determining how that wealth is spent, the students and staff and what have you, if we act together. So I think that, we are always going to be told that you can't fight City Hall. We will always be told by the powers that be that it takes money and, power in the conventional sense of the term in order to drive policy in this country. But we are the majority. Ordinary people do have a power that we do not often tap, our solidarity and our ability to grind things to a halt. And that's the kinds of discussions we need to begin to have in this country if we're going to see any sort of real transformation for the things that we want, for healthcare, for jobs, for decent living conditions and all the rest of it.
There's a sense in which almost, and you mentioned the student protests, which is a great example, but the the thing about student protests is that students, for one, they're more connected to each other, they tend to be more politically active, and they don't have the kind of domestic or familial responsibilities that someone who isn't in school might have. And with so many people sort of living on the economic brink, in sort of 2 week chunks of their lives, it seems like it would be extremely difficult to try to get, say, a major strike in a small town where that's going to mean giving up your paycheck, which will probably end up just meaning you'll be replaced by someone else. It's almost that people work in such an indentured servitude kind of capacity in this country, with the exception of a few, that's sort of one of the big hurdles in trying to get that kind of solidarity, that kind of mass protest that in the end it will probably take in order to end some of the sort of oligarchic themes that are so prevalent in government today.
Well, I think you raise an important concern, but there are two things. Number one, let's also not hold on to an antiquated notion of students. Most students today work. Many students today have families of their own. It takes, children, what have you, that they have to support. People are working jobs, often more than one, as well as putting themselves through school. So that's number one, the sort of, fantastical notion of, going off to college and having endless oodles of time for leisure and, protesting activities as a sort of sideline of the privilege is something of movies and reality of decades past. That is no longer the reality for the overwhelming majority of American students today. But setting that aside for a moment, what you raise is true. It is very, very daunting and terrifying for many workers in this country to conceive of taking action. And yet you look at some of the examples. Let's look at the most, in some ways, the most significant one, because it was historic in the strategy they used. About a year and a half ago, less actually, December of 2008 into January, the workers at Republic Windows and Doors Factory in Chicago, where I'm living now, who by the hundreds, 260 of them, I believe, sat in used a tactic out of the 1930s. They took a page from the 1930s playbook and employed it in order to basically not even get better benefits and higher wages. They were trying to just get severance pay when they were told that their factory was being shut down. And they fought against Bank of America, and they fought against the corporation. And by sitting in and taking over their stuff and basically stopping them from just simply taking the, you know, billions of dollars or millions of dollars of goodies that make these windows and doors out of there, the wealth of the company, the material that produces these things, they actually won. And they garnered enormous amounts of solidarity across this town, not just from unionized workers, but from all sorts of people, including actually LGBT activists who were pouring into the streets fighting around marriage equality at the time. And it really was a sort of transformative moment in some ways for many people in terms of their consciousness, and certainly in terms of the lives of those workers who not only won severance pay in the millions from the banks, but as a result of their actions actually had the company bought out by a sort of green windows and doors manufacturing company out of California, and many of them are now reemployed. And these workers had to develop the confidence to use that tactic and develop their solidarity and their skills for organizing out of the massive immigrant rights protests of just a year or two before, when they had taken action then and walked out during the Day Without an Immigrant protest in March, and then again May Day of 2006. So, you know, there are, it's not to say that, you know, that exceptional circumstance can become the rule throughout this country, but it gives you an inkling of what it looks like when workers can begin to have the kinds of discussions and the kinds of strategizing that have historically, you know, benefited ordinary people trying to get some sort of redress in the system.
What's encouraging about the time we live in now is that we are an extremely connected country. I mean, every movement is so well connected through things like Facebook and Twitter, and other countries, in fact, have used these sorts of modes of organization in more effective ways than we have here, ironically enough. But you do see a lot of sort of movements that were under the radar gaining a lot of strength and popularity through that kind of social organizing. Unfortunately, so much of it stops there, and the extent of your sort of political stance is the group you join on Facebook, as opposed to going to the street and actually taking some kind of action that will spur change.
Yeah, no, that's, you know, look, a lot of people get involved via the internet, and the internet is a beautiful thing in many, many ways, but you can't you can't change the world by sitting on your couch and clicking here. You actually have to get out there and organize. But I also think we have to acknowledge that there are shifts taking place around us. Just in the last weeks in Chicago and in Boston, hundreds of activists in each of these localities came together for conferences put on by Equality Across America to debate out strategies for building a national grassroots activist network to win full federal equality for LGBT people. So these are not people just sitting on their Facebook pages, although many of them did get involved initially after the Prop 8 decision in California, which overturned equal marriage rights for gays and lesbians there, basically, you know, propelled tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people into the streets right after that, and sort of began a movement that was initiated, to be blunt, on Facebook. I never would have thought that was possible, but it was. But what started in cyberspace actually has hit the streets and has continued to be a movement that has hit the streets repeatedly and come together to organize and debate. And that's where, you know, that's where change is going to be made. And so is it the majority of people? No. But it's a significant minority of people who are taking action and who are trying to mobilize their friends, their coworkers, and their families in order to actually make change, because we've clearly shifted sentiment in this country in favor of full equality for gays, lesbians, bisexuals, and transgender people. But sentiment doesn't change policy. We need actual movements to force this government to ultimately, you know, right some wrongs.
If you're just tuning in, I'm Eric Jorgensen, and I'm talking with Sherry Wolf. She's an author and a leader in the socialist movement. Her new book is Sexuality and Socialism, History, Politics, and Theory of LGBT Liberation. She's going to be talking tomorrow night at Portland State University. I believe we have a caller on the line. Joanne, you're on the air.
Yeah, Eric, I was going to say something else, but after experiencing this on your program, other people's programs at times, I'm going to say this. Eric, do you really want callers, or it seems like you let your guests dominate the program? I'll say goodbye.
All right, Joanne, thank you. Well, we do bring our guests on to speak with us about the topics which they are experts in, and Sherry Wolf has lots of knowledge and experiences to share. Let's go ahead and switch the focus. I want to talk a little bit about your new book, and I know this is one of your big sort of political issues is marriage equality and equality for LGBTQ people, and it's it seems to me that this is kind of an apotheosis of what's gone wrong in terms of creating civil equality for people in this country, because we've largely confused the idea of equality with democracy, or the idea that equal rights can be voted on. And it seems a little bit ridiculous that in the age that we are living, there's still so much political capital devoted toward this sort of archaic debate about the marriage institution. There's been some encouraging decisions in unexpected places like Iowa, but even here in Oregon, which of course we tout ourselves as a very progressive state, we don't have gay marriage in Oregon. I know there's talk about putting it on the 2010 agenda, but can you talk a little bit about some of your experiences with this, maybe about your book? Your book is a history of sort of the liberation of LGBTQ people. What is sort of the general atmosphere about this right now in the country? What's happening?
Well, first of all, the book is about sexual liberation. It's not really, of course, I take up issues around marriage equality and what position do people on the left take around issues like Don't Ask, Don't Tell and the military, while we oppose the war and the military and what it does. What should we say about equality on the job, essentially, are different things. But so let's not have our sights narrowed to the way the debate has been framed by the corporate media, which is to talk exclusively about marriage as if this is the be-all and end-all fight for people who are sexual minorities in this country. In fact, it is estimated that about 40% of homeless youth on the streets of this country are queer and are thrown out of their homes or have nowhere to go because very often places like the Salvation Army or what have you are openly anti-gay, certainly anti-trans. Those are not places for them to find relief. I think there's many, fights, including probably the most important of which in terms of our civil rights is equality on the job. And the fact is that 89% of the American population is for equal rights on the job, for non-discrimination for LGBT people. And yet, in most states in this country, it is perfectly legal not to be hired or to be fired if you are gay, lesbian, bisexual, or transgender.
Right.
This is simply a fact. And, the House of Representatives is about to take up the latest rendition of this legislation. It's called ENDA, Employment Non-Discrimination Act. It will probably go through the House and then stall in the Senate, and then there will be some stupid reactionary crap that will be said about transgender people in the bathrooms by a number of Republicans and Fox News talking heads in order to try and discredit the notion that LGBT people should have equal rights on the job. I'm not sure what they think transgender people do today. They actually go to the bathroom now. And we'll go to the bathroom after this legislation, but clearly that becomes a sort of big bugaboo for these ilks. So the book is really about the roots of LGBT oppression. Why does it persist into the 21st century? About a sort of history of struggles. How did a movement that began on the streets in a riot actually a series of riots in the 1960s, become so tepid and conservative, and how do we move forward towards sexual liberation? And I connect it to broader struggles for social and economic justice. Putting that in brief, but so you know, equal marriage rights, repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. These are components, of course, of that. But in a bizarre sort of way, I think that many of the conservative elements in our movement, and certainly in our government and the press, have sort of made that the sort of limelight issues that we're supposed to talk about. And I don't think we should narrow our discussion to that.
I was surprised and appalled when I found out, and this was only a couple of years ago, that in Oregon, sexual orientation is not one of the things that's protected by the discrimination laws in the workplace. And I don't know if a lot of people even realize this, but you know, employers aren't allowed to discriminate for race, gender, religious beliefs, but there, it's perfectly legal to discriminate based on sexual orientation, which seems utterly backwards in so many ways. I'm sorry, go ahead, Jerry.
No, go ahead. I just think that's one of the real values of discussions like this. Most people, including many LGBT people, do not know that the laws are the way they are. Most people in this country would be shocked to know that in 38 states it's perfectly legal to be fired because of your gender expression. Okay? Yeah. Now, what does that mean? It doesn't mean that you have to be transgender. It just means if you are a guy and you don't look sufficiently masculine in the eyes of your boss, whatever that's supposed to mean, or if you're a gal and you're not looking all frou-frou and femme and pleasing to your boss, then you can be ditched out of suspicion of being whatever. Not masculine or feminine enough. That is a legitimate reason to be fired in this country, in most states. So these are the fact that LGBT people are not a protected class of citizens in this country, which I think means that we need to be added to the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and be done with all of this sort of incrementalist, gradualist garbage that we go state by state, city by city, and issue by issue. Enough of it already. We want full equality and be done with this. It doesn't mean that homophobia and transphobia will cease to exist any more than racism has ceased to exist in the aftermath of the Civil Rights Act. But it means that we would have some sort of legal standing, and it actually does have an impact on general social consciousness when we have rights.
Yeah, and just ignoring the moral imperative to create protections for LGBT people, just from a pragmatic standpoint, I mean, we can see the way things are going in this country. Like, slowly but surely, people are accepting this. They're being okay with equality in this respect. You know, I think with the recent study, I said 2% of the every year support for LGBT rights grows 2% in this country. So it is happening. But, you know, it seems that we should just say, okay, so this is, we can either spend billions of dollars and a lot of energy and mental capacity on this sort of silly issue over the next decade, trying to pass it state by state and jurisdiction by jurisdiction, or we can just try to make some common sense policy changes on a fundamental sort of systemic level and be done with it and say, you know, this is a country that is about equality for everyone, regardless of your race or religion. You know, it started with, you know, religious freedom, and then it took a long time to get, you know, rights for African Americans and rights for women, and then rights for gay and lesbian people has only been something that's come up sort of in the past couple decades. But we can see the way it's going, so it's kind of mind-boggling that we don't just say, let's just do it now. And let's move on. If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Sherry Wolf. I'm Eric Jorgensen. Please call in this morning if you have a question or a comment. We're talking about socialism, specifically socialism and its relation to sexuality and the politics of LGBTQ liberation in this country. The number to call is 503-231-8187. Dell, you're on the air.
Oh, yes, I wanted to make a comment about the question of being able to fire somebody for sexual orientation and how it's not protected. And in, I think all except maybe one state of the union, unless you have a contract, a worker can be fired for no reason at all. And if it happens to be how you present yourself in your gender or whatever else, you can just be fired because somebody that your boss doesn't like you. And what's happened with the civil rights protections is bosses are trained to not mention any longer that they're firing somebody for race or age or religion. And I agree that sexual orientation and gender expression should be protected, but until we have really a much more decent employment law in general, which is that this is called the at-will worker, which means, and most places ask you to sign a thing that says, I know I'm just an at-will worker, which means you can be fired whenever you want to, whenever a boss wants to fire you. That doesn't have to be any reason.
Right, and they don't have to admit, you know, they don't have to admit their own bigotry, which is really one of the big issues. They don't have to come out and say, I'm firing you because I'm, you know, I am prejudiced against your sexual orientation or your gender identity.
Exactly. And all they have to do, if it were included in the civil rights laws, which I think it should be, but I think we need something much more far-reaching, which is to have decent employment laws for everyone, because otherwise they'll just get slightly smarter and not admit what they're firing somebody for.
Dale, thanks so much for your call. Sherry?
Okay. Yeah, no, I think the caller is absolutely, you know, on the money. The fact is, it doesn't make having legislation, protective legislation, irrelevant, but I think her point is absolutely valid, and that is if people don't create an atmosphere in which it is more costly for the bosses, both in terms of bad publicity, in terms of their money, and all the rest of that, potential work stoppages, all the rest, than having laws on the books without any enforcement is really sort of a hollow gain. I mean, let's face it, even with the conversation we were having earlier this morning about the mine disaster in West Virginia, there are laws on the books about ventilating mines, but of course the mine owners don't necessarily do that, in particular the non-union ones because there's no union fighting to pressure them, and as a result they basically just murdered 25 people. So absolutely correct, which is why I think the fight has to be both around, you know, getting civil rights protections as well as creating ongoing movements and ongoing pressure and really transforming consciousness in this country. You know, there's a reason why no black man in America, anywhere, whether it's in the Deep South or in New York City, crosses the street when a white woman is passing. This is something out of quite literally another century, but ahead of another era, because people fought and changed not just legislation, but consciousness and social reality. You know, the proliferation of, you know, biracial relationships, consciousness around all sorts of racial questions. I mean, let's face it, a year after the Supreme Court in 1967 struck down the laws barring black and white from marrying each other, the miscegenation laws, consciousness in this country, according to, I think it was a Gallup poll in 1968, was that only 20% of white people in this country thought it was okay for blacks and whites to marry. That percentage is over 90% now.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just, you know what I mean? Like, as a result of movements, as a result of reality, imposing itself, and people's ideas shift. And so I think it's important not to think that consciousness is a sort of flat thing. It's fluid and shiftable. And what human beings do, and in particular what conscious humans in organized ways, what movements do, can actually have profound impact on not just laws, but on reality, as it's lived on the ground in workplaces and communities.
Yeah. I think we have another caller on the line. This is George. George, you're on the air. Oops. Did we lose George? We lost George. No, that's a great point. I think especially when you look at things like the Don't Ask, Don't Tell, which is slowly starting to be eradicated, perhaps slower than many of us would have hoped for or expected. But, in that case, it's really the more general acceptance of homosexuals in sort of the general American populace that has empowered a lot of people in the military who were homosexual to come forward and sort of have the strength, the political force, the backing to come out and say, you know, this isn't fair. I'm, you know, I am an American soldier. I'm not fighting for, you know, Christian ethics or something like that. I'm fighting for the country, and I should be allowed just like anyone else. Which really started from people rising up, just people who aren't in the military and supporting those kinds of actions. We have another caller on the line. George, you're back. George, you're on the air.
The previous caller mentioned kind of in passing the issue of unions, labor unions. I think that's incredibly important. There's no, there's no sure protection no matter what you do. I mean, people, even in unions, can be capricious and prejudiced and so forth. But your chance, anyone's chances of fair treatment increase greatly if there is a union contract where they work. Would you agree with that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you've got to have union protections are central. I'm big pro union person. I think it's phenomenally important. And your own state just had, I don't know all the particulars of it, but wasn't there a whole fight just recently that won in order to sort of raise the taxes on corporations and the wealthy pay a higher percentage? It seems to me the unions played an important role in that.
Yeah. Oregon is a pretty good union state. I mean, it's sure not a right-to-work state like Idaho or Arizona, places like that. I mean, that's a nightmare in states like that. But even in Oregon, we need stronger unions. I noticed there's a drug company now is going to go into business in the Hillsborough area.
Genentech, yeah.
And I don't know what their union issues are, but we need to look at it. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for your call. Yeah, that's Genentech that's opening in Hillsborough, which will be interesting to see. I think they're going to be employing about 250 workers, and that's a factory where they're going to be manufacturing three new pharmaceutical products. So yeah, it'll be interesting to see what the union situation is there. It's always been interesting to me that, of course, unions are necessary, but it's a little bit disheartening that they are. I think it was John Maynard Keynes, the economist, who said something to the effect that capitalism is the crazy belief that the most wicked men will do the most wicked things for the greatest good of everyone. And it's because we can't put any kind of faith in the humanity of the people running these major organizations to be fair to their workers, which is sad, but has led to the necessary institution of the union. What is happening as far as the national progress on sort of union organization? I know there's a lot of major corporations that fight union organization with, you know, all the resources that they have. And in Oregon, we're sort of privileged to have a good union system. But I know that's not the case in large parts of the country.
Now, of course, you can only say that with a straight face about Oregon when you look at the rest of the country. But in fact, unionization rates in this country are below 12% right now. In the private sector, it's, I think, below 10%. And it's not, statistically any much higher in Oregon. So let's grapple with the reality in front of us that all over this country, unionization rates are abysmally low. And that's simply not because most people don't want to be in a union. In fact, in poll after poll in recent years, particularly in the most recent period, more people would like to be in unions but can't figure out how to get in them. And one of the promises, of course, of the Obama administration coming in was to deliver Employee Free Choice Act, you know, the sort of idea that workers should just come in, sign on a card, and become members of a union without the sort of long process that allows the bosses to basically propagandize inside of the workplace against unions, threaten people, fire them, blah, 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 which is ordinarily what happens. Now, nothing has happened with what is known as EFCA, Employee Free Choice Act, yeah. And the unions, unfortunately, have not fought for it, which, again, is why without active participation in one's union, you know, having a union is great if you use it, but it's not a sort of magical be-all and end-all. And I think that we're, again, people are going to have to sort of, I believe, revert back to some of the tactics that we used when the unions were born, which we have to remember were not legal when many workers began to take action in the early 1930s and then leading to 1934, the year of massive general strikes across this country from Toledo, Minneapolis, to San Francisco. It took people forcing bosses and forcing this government by taking action that sometimes was illegal initially in order to win unions in the first place and ultimately win things like Social Security and the weekend, which we all love, thanks to the unions. If people hadn't taken action, none of that would have happened. So that's some of what I'll be talking about tomorrow night in the Case for Socialism Talk at Portland State, because, you know, to me, it's not just a matter of taking apart one issue, but about how do we fight an entire system that is steep, you know, is based on competition and profit and begin to hack away at it. And what do we have to propose as an alternative?
Well, and that's a great point, because I feel like too often we're so short-sighted, especially in our policymaking in this country. We don't look at sort of the big systemic picture as far as how all of these different things that we're trying to fix are intrinsically interrelated, and especially interrelated at sort of the ground level, the level of the worker, the level of the people that they affect. I mean, these are not, you know, healthcare and the banks and financial regulation and unionization are all intrinsically tied, and yet, you know, we try to at a policy level attack them as if they're sort of isolated entities and sitting in cubicles. If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Sherry Wolfe this morning. She's the author of Sexuality and Socialism, History, Politics, and Theory of LGBT Liberation. Coming up this morning on KBOO, please stay tuned for 9 o'clock. It's Political Perspectives. The guest is Father Roy Bourgeois, who has long worked to end U.S. government-funded combat training of Latin American militaries. He'll discuss the child sexual abuse scandal in the Catholic Church and his support for the ordination of women. At 10 o'clock, it's Air Cascadia, headlines and interviews and commentary with Chris Andrea and Liam Delta. 10:15 is Flashpoints. No, it's off today. I'm sorry. Instead, we'll hear Law and Disorder, which features a look at the Take Back the Land movement demanding housing for the homeless in Miami, New York City, and South Africa. Also, we'll hear about a legal challenge to experimental prison units designed to monitor and control the communications of mostly Muslim prisoners. And we hear stories from an event titled FBI Entrapment, Personal Stories of Preemptive Prosecution. And finally, at 11, the Bike Show will examine the plans for the new North Portland Greenway Bike and Pedestrian Path. Again, I'm Eric Jorgensen. You're listening to KBOO. And on the phone this morning is Sherry Wolfe, who's an activist and a leader in the International Socialist Organization, one of the organizers for the National Equality March. If you'd like to call in, you still have time. The number this morning is 503-231-8187. Sherry, could you talk a little bit about what else you're going to be talking about tomorrow night? You're speaking tomorrow night again, I should mention. That's at Portland State University, the Smith Memorial Student Union Building. That's right there in the Park Blocks, room 294. That's tomorrow, April 8th. It's at 8 p.m. You can find more information about that at the Portland State University website. Also, there'll be information about that on the KBOO website later today. What else are you going to be speaking about tomorrow night?
Well, in essence, I'm going to talk about the fact that the failures of the free market are no accident, but an inevitable result of the thirst for profit. That really, this is the madness of the free market. Capitalism does one thing very, very well. It protects and increases the wealth of the people at the top of the society in the short term. And so meeting the needs of everybody else is secondary, if it even comes into play at all, which is why so many people's needs go unmet. So from every other point of view, from producing enough on the ground to go around, to protecting the environment, to building a society of equality and freedom, the capitalist system is utterly useless. And that's what I believe. And I want to make a case for, you know, an alternative system based on ordinary people who produce the wealth in society determining democratically how to run that society, which is, in essence, what socialism is about.
Well, and I mean, wealth disparity in this country has never been so polarized. I forget the actual numbers, but it's, you know, high 90s, some odd percent of the wealth resides in, you know, 1% of the population. I think everyone knows that and feels that. In fact, the conditions, the economic conditions in that regard are not so different from what they were leading up to the French Revolution, which was a monarchy that then became a sort of form of democracy. But that's almost the same that we have in this country. It's become such an oligarchy, and people tend to sort of be passive about it because these people that have all the money are so far removed from the rest of society in the country that we sort of say, oh yeah, well, you know, the gazillionaires. But it's true that these people, I mean, I think the CEO of Walmart makes something like 600 times what the average Walmart employee is making. And I mean, this is just crazy. This is, that's the kind of blatant disregard for any kind of fair wages or fairness at all, or even human concern is sort of, has been stripped from that through this sort of drive for profit.
Mm-hmm. Well, look, if you want to get the degree of the bankruptcy of the system, you know, in a nutshell, if you took the wealth of four human beings in the United States, Bill Gates, Sam Walton, Larry Ellison of Oracle, and Warren Buffett, who's a financial kingpin, right. If you took their wealth, you would eradicate tomorrow world hunger. I mean, it is on that scale. And so it's not like we have to come up with all sorts of dreamy conceptions of what sorts of things could happen, although there's all sorts of things we are going to have to create anew. But, you know, the food exists in the world for people to be fed, but there's no profit in feeding poor people, and that's why people starve to death to the tune of 6 million children a year, and God knows how many other millions who go malnourished, undernourished, or, food insecure, I guess is the government's euphemistic way of referring to hungry people in the United States. They dump food in this country in order to keep the profits artificially high for ConAgra and for Archer Daniels Midland. Obviously, what's happening to the environment is devastating and will continue to happen because there's profit in obliterating the environment. And there's even profit, it appears, in these sort of green capitalist, mechanisms of, clean coal. And all sorts of hoo-ha, and now we're being told, I'm in my early 40s, the first march I was ever on in my life was in 1981 when I was a teenager against nukes in Central Park in New York, where there were about a million people, and now we're being told by the Liberal president that nuclear power is a good thing. I don't think he'd want to locate a nuclear facility next to the White House, however. a mistake could obliterate the planet. So this is the kinds of solutions that capitalism comes up with for the kinds of crises that capitalism creates. And I think that, for most of us, that is not sufficient. And we need to debate and discuss out, how we are going to, not only fight this system, but what would we replace it with?
Well, and the entire capitalist system is based on this idea of incentive, and of course things are going to end up the way they are when you have a system created like that. I mean, the only reason to, if you're very wealthy, to give some of your money away largely is because you get a tax break, and so you get to keep other certain aspects of your money. Oh, and I just got a note here. I should mention that the talk tomorrow starts at 7, not 8 o'clock at Portland State University. Thank you. So not to be confused, that's tomorrow night at 7, not 8 o'clock at Portland State. But it's sort of, we have a political system that has ignored sort of the basic empathy that's sort of inherent in us all. I mean, we don't do things largely because we actually care about that cause. We do them because we have incentive, because we need to live and to have money and to create wealth, which has led to this situation where, like you said, we have enough food to feed everyone in the world. We have enough housing in this country to house every single person. And yet all we're doing is kicking more people out of their houses and onto the street. And I don't know who thinks that this is going to create any kind of sustainable long-term wealth for anyone. But it seems totally crazy to me.
Yes. Yeah, no, it's crazy to most people, and that's the starting point. But I think that it's crucial that people not be so daunted by the tasks that face us, because they can be daunting, that it can become paralyzing for many people. And the fact is, there are millions of people in this country who would love to do something about the reality around them. In fact, there are millions of people who are doing, in some small way, something to better their circumstances, and not just for themselves, but for their communities, for their workplaces, for their schools. And I think that we need to talk about what kind of organizational means and what kind of politics, both historically and today, are applicable for us to change the world. To put it, if it doesn't sound too frou-frou, that is what we need to do. So why don't we talk about it that way? And, Howard Zinn, who I love dearly as a writer, as a historian, as an activist, and I knew him a little bit, met him when I was a young activist and saw him many times over the years, and he had this wonderful, wonderful thing to say about politics that I just thought, is applicable now. He said this in an interview to socialistworker.org a while back. He said, "There's hardly anything more important that people can learn than the fact that the really critical thing isn't who is sitting in the White House, but who is sitting in the streets, in the cafeterias, in the halls of government, in the factories. Who is protesting, who is occupying offices and demonstrating? Those are the things that determine what happens." And I think he's absolutely, he was absolutely right then, and he's absolutely right now. And that's some of what we're going to talk about tomorrow night in the Case for Socialism discussion of Portland State at 7.
Fantastic. Just to clarify that, like I said, that is at 7 o'clock, the talk tomorrow night, not 8, as I mistakenly said earlier. Sherry Wolf has been joining us this morning. She is a journalist, a writer, an activist. Her new book is Sexuality and Socialism, History, Politics, and Theory of LGBT Liberation. She's going to be talking tomorrow night at Portland State University at the Smith Memorial Student Union Building, room 294. Everyone is invited. The talk is at 7 o'clock. It's going to be great. Please don't miss it. Sherry Wolf, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you. Take care.
You too. I'm Eric Jorgensen. You've been listening to KBOO 90.7 in Portland. It's Wednesday. Thanks for listening. Tune in next week.